podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
From Autosport.com and Autosport Magazine, I'm Martin Lee, and this is the Autosport Podcast. It's that time of the week. Welcome back to the third in our third series of our top 10 lists. And if you haven't catched the previous one yet, you can do that in the podcast archive right now. Joined by three guests today. Welcome back to our chief editor, Kevin Turner. What's the list you've put together for us this week?
So this is a bit more difficult to define than the last couple, but hopefully still fun. Top 10 one-hit wonders.
What do you mean?
In Formula One. So these are people that only won one World Championship Grand Prix. So I'm kind of rating them both on their careers as drivers that might want to race, but also the quality of their one win.
Yes.
So it's kind of weighing those two things together.
One
There's
win.
There's also a bit of shock factor involved, which comes in much higher up the list.
How did they do it? What was the race? What were they driving?
Exactly.
All those things come
into
play.
But also, what was their overall career like?
Oh,
so that
you
has
do count
factor
the,
that in as,
you count the career
which is quite
as well.
A difficult balance to get, you see. Yeah. I thought that made... Well... A couple of people on the list I thought had to be on the list, even though the actual race they won perhaps wasn't as mega as some of the others they did.
We'll find out what our fellow guests think about your list and whether they would reorder it somewhat. Our second guest from the first two podcasts is motorsport journalist Damian Smith. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Always nice to see you in person, although I feel like I see you each week because I have Autocard delivered through my letterbox. So I have your face smiling at me.
My ugly mug in the corner there.
Yes, writing.
It's a very friendly face, isn't it?
It's
always
face.
Nice to see. But although I did think at the Autosport Awards, it felt like there were about 18 Damian Smiths. Because every time I came around a corner, Damo was stood there.
I was haunting you, wasn't I?
Yeah, but they're actually very helpful because we had a few last minute dramas that Damo stepped up heroically to help
with. He is very heroic.
He's very heroic.
That's what everyone says. Yeah, I noticed that.
Any fellow listeners who also like to read magazines, as I do, because I love a magazine, much to my wife's annoyance, because you told me you needed the big screen iPad to read magazines on the iPad, and then it's in the drawer. But I just love, and I probably have too many. But there is that thing that if you do read magazines as well, there's the little picture of the person who wrote the story. Now, I can tell you that there's plenty of people who look nothing like that picture because it was taken many years ago. But Damien, you do. You do indeed look like...
Well, thank you.
You see the magazine, you look like yourself.
I suppose that's a good thing, yeah. I think that there's a certain person on Autosport whose photo is quite old, let's just say.
I think we're kind and should leave it.
You should leave it, yeah.
I once got accused of having a fake beard put on my picture to make myself look older. I mean, there's a lot to unpack there, which we won't do now.
No.
I thought that was an odd thing to criticise someone for.
Well, had our 70th Autosport edition. Goodness, it was during lockdown and that whole time is a blur in my brain. But I look back at the 60th magazine... And Kev, you're very fresh-faced, like that 12 years ago. I'm like, who is that? And it says your name, so it must be you.
It's not the time; it's the mileage. I think is the question, and the number of children.
That's
as well,
the thing. It would be pre-children.
Ages you, yeah, pre-children, yeah.
I might
child myself in 2000. Yes, well, six when I started.
Yeah,
but obviously it's 2010 that 60th that you're talking about was in, yeah. We had a picture of the whole staff, didn't we, at the back?
Yeah, sort of taken from a high-up camera.
Which we couldn't do, and some copy and pasting.
Oh, really?
Photoshopping to get a few people that may not have been able to make it.
I was on the 50th, and we did the photo in Hampton Road in Teddington, where our office was in those days, and there were quite a few people who weren't there. And as you can imagine, that the Mac work in those days, wasn't really... You could tell quite a lot.
There was a clamour from certain members of staff to have one for the 70th, but on the basis that it was in the middle of a pandemic, didn't think that was a very good reason to get everyone together from the various corners of the country that they were then in.
You could have had maybe like a page of selfies all in remote areas.
See, that's the modern thinking, you see.
Yeah, like on Anton Deck's show when they have all of their audience on a big screen.
Yeah, exactly.
I always look awful in selfies, though.
Everyone does.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
So let's get on to our third guest.
Who's appeared in none of these pictures.
Digitally, we could do it, I guess. But
yeah.
Well, maybe not. Hayden Cobb, editor of autosport.com. You weren't here 12 years ago. But so
go
you
on, tell us, what were
photo.
You doing 12 years ago? Hang on, go on. We might as well finish yourself.
Still at school.
Brilliant.
I'm so sorry.
Good, I love this. It just makes Kevin really old. I love it.
It was secondary school, so...
It doesn't help.
Yeah. But yes, I mean, I wouldn't have been against a photo in the 70th one, but the excuse to the hello police officer, why are you all here together, not social distancing, we just wanted a picture that doesn't quite fly. So yeah, and not to mention everyone's spread out to the far corners of the country. It would have been even harder to sort out. So
well, Hayden does deserve to be in a photo as well, because his hair is always amazing.
It is, isn't it? It's immaculate.
It's kind of slightly annoyingly good.
There's a reason this is a podcast, not a video, though. So that's
because I'm in it.
But the photo would have been a work event, so it would have been fine. No cheese and wine.
That's true. Yes. Yeah. Oh.
A work event. Anyway, let's get into the podcast today and argue this one out. One hit wonders. Who's in 10th spot? Kev.
So number 10 is Jean Alesi, 1995 Canadian Grand Prix. So as a race, I mean, it was a decent race. He overtook teammate Gerhard Berger. He did overtake Damon Hill. David Coulthard spun off. I mean, he was running a decent second, but he was never going to catch Marcus Schumacher's Benetton. And then Chewy had a gearbox problem and Alesi came through to win. So it wasn't an epic drive. I'm sure it isn't his race in my life. He picked a different race, which he did with, I think, with Charles Bradley during the pandemic. So, but he's on there. Jean's on there because it's Jean Alesi and he should have won more races. You know, he had almost Chris Amon levels of bad luck at various points when he was at Ferrari. You know, cameras falling off and hitting cars with Berger, problems from the pit stop when he's leading at Monza.
That's the same race.
94 and then 95. I think he had two successive problems, didn't he, with Ferrari. And then, of course, in 97 at Monza, he should have won but got jumped in the pits by DC and McLaren. Mm. Even DC says, yeah, it was basically race won by the pit stops. Mm. And he had all sorts of things stopping winning. And if you remember that incredible impact he had when he arrived in F1, you know, fourth on his Grand Prix debut, repassing Senna at Phoenix at the start of 1990. He was a great person to have on the grid. Everyone liked him. He was fever. He was what we'd call a fever driver. But he wasn't the complete package. I think that, you know, we'd probably, looking around the table, think we'd agree that he wasn't the complete package. But he definitely deserved to be a Grand Prix winner. So that's why he's on the list.
Yes, it's a relief that he won that one, because it would have been wrong for him not to have a Grand Prix win. But he did have, as you say, a lot of close calls. I think the Monza 95 really hurt him, because that's obviously in front of the Tifosi. I think he was 8 laps from home when the car broke and handed to Johnny Herbert. You know, so it was painful at times. But everyone who worked with him loved him as a character and as a person to have around the team. But obviously he could be infuriating when he forgot to stop for fuel and things like that in Australia.
I think he was at Prost when he switched off the traction control in Monaco 1 year. So it's, because from a fan's point of view, that's just totally cool. But from an engineering, get the best out of the equipment, it's like you probably could do something between getting annoyed about it and switching it off completely. You know, it's that kind of thing. But I think that's why people loved him, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a few on this list that you say the feel-good factor came when it eventually arrived, and just, yeah, as you said, sort of how much he was adored by his team and fellow drivers, but also huge hit with the fans. And, yeah, I guess the combination of perhaps it'd be interesting to see where other people sort of argue on this list is those near misses almost make that one hit wonder better.
Absolutely, yeah.
Or indeed, depending on the context, worse. Because it's like, you've just said there that, yeah, sure, he's a one-hit wonder, but he probably should have won far more. Shouldn't even technically be on this list.
Yeah, exactly. He sort of shouldn't be on the list, but because he is, then that meant they had to be on it, if that makes sense.
Totally,
he had to be represented. Stay with us. We won't win more sense.
But it was also, Canada 95 was also the last win for a V12.
Yes, it would have been. Yeah, because 95 was the last season. The 412 T2 was the last V12.
Yeah, they went
Ferrari,
V10 next year. So that's fitting that it was a Ferrari V12. And it was Jean Alesi driving it. That just makes a lot of sense.
And of course, number 27,
absolutely,
Circuit Gilles Villeneuve.
Yeah.
That was appropriate as well. So yeah, it was
the story right itself.
It was just a great feel good factor.
Sounds to me like you're arguing him up the list. Let's find
I think
let's
there's good to go on there.
Number nine
is Giancarlo Baghetti at the 1961 French Grand Prix. So this is kind of a different story, really. Although the race itself, again, he had the older V6 as opposed to the 120-degree V6 that his teammates had. But it was his first World Championship Grand Prix start. And he'd bizarrely, he'd already won two F1 races by then because he'd won the two non-championship F1 races before that. And he started 12th, and he was in a slipstream battle most of the times at Reims, the French Grand Prix, and all the quick cars basically fell out, and he found himself in a duel in the closing stages with Dan Gurney in a Porsche. And essentially, I mean, he outpowered Gurney. He's always going to have the run from the last corner to the start-finish line, so he won by a tenth of a second. So as a race, again, not perhaps the finest performance. Certainly we'll get to better ones on the list. But to win a World Championship Grand Prix on your debut...
And By that margin?
Yeah, exactly. Holy, cool event. Yeah. And I don't count Farina winning on his Grand Prix World Championship debut because he was the established Grand Prix driver. It just happened to be the first World Championship race. And we're excluding the Indy 500 drivers because they weren't Grand Prix either. So, I think that's just a kind of a cool story. And then his career just didn't go anywhere after that start. So it's a really odd career.
But he won his first three Formula One races because there was two non-championship races as well. It's just amazing.
And he was Italian F1 champion that year, I think.
Is that right?
I think there was an Italian F1 title. Yeah. There's a few races thrown together and called a championship, which is just bizarre.
Well, one of the many great things about Nigel Roebuck, formerly of this parish, is that when when old Formula One drivers used to turn up to Grand Prix at Monza or whatever, and no one recognised them, Nigel obviously did. Not only that, he'd then go and talk to them and interview them, and he's got all these great interviews, all these old... And he interviewed Baghetti one year and spoke to him, and he was lovely, just a lovely man, apparently. And he did carry on and have a so-so career, but it never just... He started where everyone else wants to finish, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd say this is the second most random, surprising one on the list, and we'll get to the number one much higher up. But I think this is the most like,
okay, yeah,
how
yeah.
did that happen? Moment.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Yeah.
You had Hayden one of those moments of huh?
Yeah, okay. Massively. And so like, say, career,
there's a name, okay?
Career peaking at the start and then petering out massively, but just a nice oddity. Makes for a lovely, lovely feature. I think one of our colleagues could probably just write a whole piece on that race and on Baghetti. It's just wonderful, really. Mm.
Okay, yeah. Moving on, number eight.
Number eight. So listeners of previous episodes will know I've got a bit of a hobby horse about this anyway. But number eight is Robert Kubica at the 2008 Canadian Grand Prix. I think this is probably a better win in a way than the previous two, but it still does rely on the comedy, Kimi Raikkonen and Lewis Hamilton not seeing a red light and just driving into... Well, actually, he has a choice. He's got Raikkonen on one side and Kubica's BMW on the other.
Nice luck,
and Lewis, for this list, made the right choice. Tacked into the back of Kimi, a very unimpressed Kimi Raikkonen, and off went Kubica to take his only win. A year after that enormous accident at Montreal. Really one of the worst, I'd say, in recent F1... Can we say recent? Is 2007 still recent?
I think so.
It begins with a two, so it's recent.
Yeah, you've still got active drivers that were on.
Yes, I like that. Well, yeah, Fernando Alonso is still going 20.58.
But that gives you that nice stretch. Back,
that's nice. So, I like that. That's good logic.
But that was high speed, scary to see. Just one of those accidents. You think, oh goodness, how. Yeah,
and
horrible.
He was incredible in 2008. You know, I think after that race, he was actually leading the championship.
Yep.
And, you know, it was a good win. You know, he had to make his two-stop work. He was helped by his teammate, Nick Heidfeld, as we've sort of mentioned before. But he's on the list, really, again, it's for what he could have achieved and how good he was. A little bit like a Lacy deserved to be a Grand Prix winner. But I think, unlike a Lacy, I think he was the complete package. We just didn't get to see it because of his rally accident.
Is that why he... came back and wanted, or he tried to come back to Formula One?
Yeah, I think it was the case of one of those guys who, again, he knew how good he was. He knew what he'd lost. And I think there must have been a lot of personal, just a battle within himself to prove to himself that he could come back. And it was a target to push him on, I think. Yeah, great story, isn't it, really? You know, his comeback. Who cares how he got on? The fact he came back at all is a miracle, I think.
Yeah, massively. And one of those that had things gone more fortunate and in the right way, he wouldn't even be on this list at all because he wouldn't be a one-hit wonder. He, in fairness, with the right circumstances and machinery to an extent, he'd be multiple Grand Prix winner. Arguably could even be a world champion. That was what many pegged him as a future world champion. But unfortunately never came to be. But again, much like Lacy, sort of the nice story... sort of encapsulated the connections of it, like you mentioned about the crash the year before at the same venue, and just it was a nice sort of oddity about it as well. sort of like the other ones.
Okay, right, moving on, number seven.
Another feel-good one, I think.
Go on.
Number seven, Olivier Panis, 1996 Monaco Grand Prix. Yeah. You know, Ligier hadn't won a race for 15 years, yeah. And obviously Panis didn't win any others, and Ligier became Prost shortly afterwards. Mm. 14th on the grid at Monaco. You know, Monaco often has rubbish, boring races, doesn't it? But every now and again, it throws up something completely ridiculous and amazing. And that was it. The reason it's not higher up is because, you know, Damon Hill had that race in his pocket. You know, he was, and that would have been such a nice story as well, you know, at the track that his dad had won so many times. And he really was driving brilliantly. Damp start, Schumacher crashed. Mm. Hill didn't, had the lead, and he just completely disappeared down the road. He had a very rare Renault engine failure. And I think Jean Lacy had a suspension problem. I think it was a suspension. Again, another race he could have won, but was robbed. But to be fair to Panis, he'd overtaken a lot of cars as well, including one of my favourite moves on Eddie Irvine at the hairpin, which left Eddie furious and stationary for a moment. Because to pass around Monaco, you have to take risks like that. Otherwise, you just follow him a leader. And also, what we found out when we spoke to him about this is that he'd been told to pit for fuel towards the end because it was one of those drying, go move to slick races. And he said, "There's no way I'm coming in," because he was only a few seconds ahead of Davy Coulthard. He knew that he was never going to, that he would lose the win. So he turned it on to full lean and cruised around as much as he could. Bearing in mind that DC was only a couple of seconds behind, it wasn't like he had a huge lead to sit on. And I think everyone's pleased that he did manage to get to the end and take the win. So, yeah, another feel-good one, I think.
Mm. Yeah, one of those being in right place, right time, but like you say, made the moves to be in the right place at the right time. That probably comes up in a few of the other ones as well. And, yeah, I guess feel-good, I can't really doubt it, really, in terms of where else it would be. It certainly is above the first three that we've mentioned in this list.
And like you say, the venue makes a difference as well. The fact that it's at that circuit where passing isn't easy, and as you say, the races are often processional, but occasionally you get an event like this. Or a driver is nursing a car home that has no right to win that race, and then they go and win Monaco. You know, so it's those kind of stories that make you think, "Oh, what a great event!"
And it was Ligier. I love it. I love that. When I was a child of the 80s, I loved Ligiers when I was a little boy. So to see Ligier win again out of the blue so many years later was very cool.
It's the sort of random result that it's good to have in F1, well, in your championship, but in F1. Yeah. It's like almost, we've said this before, it's almost like F1's got, they're all a bit too good. Yeah. I mean, in 2021, we did get a couple of sort of surprising ones, didn't we?
But Panis had some momentum at that stage, didn't he? And into 97, he was driving really well until he got that broken leg in Canada.
That kind of
put the brakes on for a while, and he never quite got that momentum back, did he, in terms of his career?
No, he didn't. And actually, didn't he chase? I think he chased Jacques Villeneuve quite closely in, I want to say, the Spanish Grand Prix earlier on. Because the Bridgestone-Prost combo was kind of a bit the surprise package at the start of the year. Mm. And as you say, riding high, you know. Panis was a good driver, and he had quite a long career. I don't think, again, one of these that wasn't a megastar, but it was great that he had his day of days.
Okay, next on the list.
Number six, Gunnar Nielsen, 1977 Belgium GP. So Nielsen's is a bit of a sort of tragic story. He kind of could be easily forgotten because he wasn't really around that long. He died of cancer within about a year and a half of... we're taking this win, but it's actually a really well taken victory, where it's essentially another one of these sort of wet drying races. He started third for Lotus, and he has to close down and overtake Niki Lauda. I mean, that I think is a pretty, in the Ferrari, who's on his way to winning his second world title, and there's no doubt about it. You know, he catches him and he nails him and he goes away. So it's a race that he's gone out and earned. It's not one where other people have had to fall out. You know, he's gone ahead and won it. And I think, given what happened to him subsequently, and the fact that he was very much in the shadow of Mario Andretti, who was sort of rebuilding with Colin Chapman Lotus after some really, really dodgy couple of years, and they were kind of just getting into that ground effects, about to be setting the pace. It's nice that Nielsen got his. We keep saying that, don't we? But I think it's. I think it's a reminder that he was actually a talent that shouldn't be forgotten.
David Purley in the Lek held up Lauda and caused a right old stink, didn't he? Because Lauda was furious with him, and David Purley as next Marine didn't care too much.
How do you feel about how is the list coming together so far? Do you want to argue anyone up or down? We're halfway through.
I think the nice thing about the Nielsen win, as Kev said, is it was a properly earned win. It wasn't an inherited win per se. You know, he actually went out and won that race. And all these so far, there's definitely that feel-good factor we've talked about is definitely part of it. I think this one's quite hard to judge from a sort of a scientific point of view, but it's deeply subjective, and I'm liking what I'm seeing so far. How about you, Hayden? What do you
very
think?
Much agree, yeah. One on merit, but also extremely impressive merit. So who is beating at the time? Whereas the other ones we've had previously, there has been that slice of good fortune in some shape or form, or in a lot of forms, for pretty much all the other plans. So that's why, for me, it ranks where it is at the moment.
All right, we're halfway through. We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll check out the top 5 one-hit wonders in Formula One. Stick around. Okay, welcome back to the podcast. Another one of our top 10 lists. Well, it's not ours, it's Kev's top 10 list. So we're going through them and seeing if we disagree with where you've put the drivers. The third show in this third series has been very cordial, Kev. No arguments. I mean, there's never really any arguments, are there, on these podcasts?
No, not normally. I mean, I hope it sparks some good debate and some fun. I mean, I think maybe because this is such a subjective one, this isn't one where, I think with the drivers and the cars ones, you can kind of stick to more specific criteria. With this, because you're trying to balance both the actual event itself and the drivers' careers, it's more of a discussion point, isn't it, to highlight some, you know, everyone knows about, you know, Mark Schumacher in 91 wins and Lewis Hamilton with 103 and all that sort of stuff. This is highlighting some of the other drivers that further down the list of the 103 World Championship winners.
Well, let's work our way up the list. Who's at number 5?
Vittorio Brambilla at the 1975 Austrian Grand Prix. This is like the Nielsen one, but even better, because he charges through from 8th on the grid.
Yep.
He passes Lauda and James Hunt and disappears down the road. And he's almost half a minute ahead when they red flag it.
And spins across the line.
So the famous image.
The style.
It's just comedy. It's just one of those, you know, he crashes the car across the line, presumably in huge surprise that he's won, and crumples. So there's images of him going around on the slowdown lap with the front of the march, all ruined and crumpled. But actually, I think that can overshadow how good the race drive was. You know, he went past Hans Stuck, who was, you know, wet weather master. You know, he did a lot of fantastic drives in the wet, both in F1 and obviously in sports car racing. Went past Lauda, went past Hunt, and was completely on a different planet on that day. So I think this is a genuine, like, proper win. From further back and more emphatically than Nielsen. So that's why he makes the... Are you looking at...
I thought I'd better go and look at that image.
It's a great image, isn't it?
and to have a look. And he's got his hand in the air on the cool-down lap, but it's a pretty...
Is he celebrating or is he calling for a new front wing?
Probably both at the same time.
Yeah, or letting the drivers behind him know he's going slowly. You don't know, but...
There's loads of great stories about Brambilla, and his brother was a mechanic, and they were a bit of a double act. And I remember my dad telling me a story when I was a kid about him giving a lift, I think it was to his brother, on the back of a Formula One car at a test session and out on the circuit. I think it had broken down. They got it going again. He said, "I'll give you a lift back to the pits." And his brother got on the back of the car and he forgot he was there and went a bit quick and got back to the pits, and his brother was sort of looking rather shocked. Still there.
Yeah, that's important.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's right. I'd have to double check that one. I've only just thought of it. But he was a real real character of the scene. But in terms of career, if this list has anything about sort of career kind of influence and longevity and importance in Formula One, I mean, Alesi's got to be much further up and Brambilla further down, I'd have thought.
I think that's where this one is quite difficult. It's more almost a discussion about the 10, because Brambilla in terms of ability would be much further down, you know, and impact would be much further down. You'd have Alesi and Kubica much higher. The reason it's there is because of the nature of that particular win. I think is a really strong drive, almost outstanding within his career, where there's actually some of the ones further down the list doesn't necessarily stand out in their individual careers.
I've just watched the Bernie Eccleston series that's coming out on Discovery Plus that's just been released, and I've seen the second episode, which covers a bit of this race, and there's some really great archive footage of Bernie going absolutely mad in the pit lane to stop the race. That it's too dangerous, and that, you know, the rain's coming down, and basically just losing his rag completely, which you didn't see very often. That was interesting. Mm. The other bit that was interesting was after the race, Bernie in a porter cabin, a table covered in money, and basically starting to count it out and giving up and just sort of scooping it into a massive case and talking to, basically he's just been paid and he's going to dish out the money to the promoters and get out of there as quick as he can, basically. And it's a fantastic footage if you get the chance to see it. And that's from 75 Austria.
Wow. Yeah, definitely nice. That sounds amazing.
I think it fits into the legend quite well of just suitcases or, you know, backpacks of money.
The whole time, mad 70s Formula One. That's what it's all about. And that sort of encapsulates that era, I think.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on and up the list. Who's next?
So number four is Jarno Trulli, 2004 Monaco Grand Prix. And this is almost like a perfect weekend performance, really. Trulli got, I think, a bit of an unfair reputation in the races, you know, the Trulli train, all the rest of it. But really, it's because he was so good at qualifying. And then if the car's not quick enough, they tend to, you know, him and Ralf Schumacher used to end up in the same place because that's where the performance of the car was when they were at Toyota. And let's remember who his teammate was for that race. That was Fernando Alonso, who he pulled away from in the first stint. Beat to pole by myself. In fact, Nigel Roebuck, in his at the end of the season, said that Trulli's pole lap was probably about as close to perfection as a car and driver has ever been. Now, Nigel has seen some stuff, man. So for him to say that is pretty remarkable. And I think Trulli is one of the great qualifiers, even though he would never really make anyone's list of greatest racing drivers. But actually, I think he was fantastically quick over one lap. But here he nailed the whole weekend, and it wasn't the Trulli train behind him. You know, he pulled away. There was a threat from Schumacher and the very fast F2004, which won just about everything else that year. Mm. But then he had one of his crazy moments with Juan Pablo Montoya in the tunnel behind the safety car, where they managed to crash into each other, which was, I mean, not really befitting of either of them. But that removed the Ferrari threat. Alonso had crashed. But then he had to deal with Jenson Button in the BAR, the Honda, coming at him late in the race, and he didn't make mistakes, and, you know, he really looked in control the whole weekend. Fantastic qualifying performance. Now, looked like someone who surely must win other races, but it never really happened for him, and he lost the drive, and I would suggest that he probably would have done a better job in the 2005 Renault than Giancarlo Fisichella, who replaced him.
Ooh. Yeah, that's the arguments you put across there. That's probably why I actually put it a bit lower in terms of, yes, he drove for the front and was there, but it was Monaco as well, famously much easier to defend there than probably anywhere else, and with those hitting trouble or for various reasons directly behind him, so he didn't necessarily need to get involved in that. But yeah, so a combination of that where things came towards him, came to his favour, and another one that probably should have won a few more and therefore wouldn't be sort of eligible for this list, I guess is what I would put into it. But it's nice to have him on the list, I think. Yeah. Certainly justified, but probably a bit lower for me.
I think the reason I put it there is partly because I think as a career, Trulli is ahead of Brambilla and Nielsen, Panis.
But
and
going on
as,
the,
a, as an individual race, he's race probably itself, ahead of Canada, 2008 Canada, 1961 French Grand Prix and 1995 Canada. So as a combination of career plus that event is what gets him up so high.
He properly won that race. So you remember when like people would say, like, oh, this year, Modena and Atturil, he could be pretty good, and he was, and he didn't quite win the race.
Oh, 91 Monaco.
Second, wasn't he? Yeah. And it was that year where a lot of people said, Trulli in a Renault around Monaco, this could be his chance, and it was, and he took it. And he took it emphatically, and I thought it was a really, it seemed like the start of something big. Well, it didn't quite work out that
and
way.
Actually, he'd been outpacing Alonso more often than not in that first part of 2004.
Yeah.
I mean, he probably rightly actually didn't think that he was Flavio Briatore's man, and that was Alonso. Yeah. And obviously, Alonso is a force. But at that point, Trulli was, you know, doing pretty well against him.
A little Trulli story. My second Autosport Awards in 97, he was a guest and he was flying into Heathrow, and I was only 22, 23 years old, something like that, and I was on the staff, and I was given an S-Class Mercedes, probably broke all sorts of insurance rules, and told to go and pick him up from Heathrow. And me and my colleague Tim Scott went to Heathrow to pick him up on the Sunday afternoon. He flew in, and Tim sat in the back while I was the chauffeur and interviewed him on the way to the Grosvenor. And he was lovely, really charming, and it was quite cool picking up this new F1 driver, taking him to the awards. And what really impressed me was at the end of the night, I was standing around, I was always at one of the back tables at that stage because I was a junior, you know. He sought me out just to say thank you and shook my hand. Aww. And thanks for picking me up. And he was a real gent.
Nice, lovely.
We like that. Yeah, class move, that is. Yeah, that's a class move.
And I just thought, actually, remember, he had led very early on in his career with Prost when he got thrown in the opportunity. Yeah, he was a real talent, truly. I think he was one of those drivers that needed the car to be perfect. Mm. It had to be right in that narrow band of, you know, he wasn't the sort of guy that's going to haul. Yeah, he's not the sort of, he's not an Alonso that's going to go airborne, have bits fall off a car and go, no, I've got this, chaps. Yeah. I'm going to get it back, put some plasters on it, and I'll go back out there.
I always remember our deputy editor now, Marcus Simmons, who was on the staff even back then, used to rave about him in Formula 3. I mean, he was, you know, he was going to be mega, basically. And he was really quick, but he just never quite plugged together the career we kind of hoped for him.
Mm. I've opened up a picture of his podium win next to Rubens and Jensen, just to bring back some memories of watching that. And yeah, fascinating to look back at those days and think, goodness, yeah, like there was some untapped potential there. And he actually drove some half-decent cars, or at least had the potential to be half-decent.
I think that's the key. I think half-decent in the 70s and 80s was enough to get you a win occasionally when the quick stuff broke down. I think half-decent in the 21st century gets you seventh. And maybe a fifth or a sixth if they play Skittles at the first course.
Remember, it came in 04, which was one of the Schumacher mega seasons, which was deeply dull most of the time because he was so dominant. So it was a really nice sort of story we all needed at the time.
It was quite a difficult one to watch, though, because Jensen was still after his first win at that point as well.
Yeah.
Been struggling for years. And he's like, oh, I can't like either of these guys to win. Mm. So it's not going to be a Ferrari this time.
Right, let's get onto the podium and our top three. Start with number three, obviously.
Peter Gethin, 1971 Italian Grand Prix. He chose it as his race of my life. Although he had a very good career, mainly outside of F1 in Formula 5000. And did beat the F1 cars at Brands Hatch in 73, although most of them did break down. But this one, he actually dropped away from, it was a slipstream, it was the last Italian Grand Prix before they put the chicanes in, so the average speed was ridiculous. The winning average speed was almost 151 miles an hour, which is quicker than the average speeds now, and I think even in the 70s they thought that was perhaps a little bit much. So he was in a slipstream battle. He actually dropped away and broke BRM's rev limit by about 500 rpm to chip away, get back to it, and he just arrived in the closing stages. He did need a bit of luck, a few of the quick, even he said that teammate Joe Siffert could probably have won it. We've talked previously about Chris Amon's bad luck in a previous episode. He could have won that race for Matra.
Mike Hailwood could be on this list, couldn't he? He was in the mix for that one as well.
Yeah, Mike Hailwood. Yeah, well, I mean, he was a candidate for best drivers not to win a Grand Prix, actually. He was sort of outside, didn't quite make it into the 10. So there's Ronnie Peterson, who at that point hadn't won a race. Francois Sever, who hadn't won his Grand Prix yet. So another candidate for this didn't quite make it on. Howden Ganny in effectively the third BRM, and Howard in the Surtees. And there's footage of this you can find. It's a great last lap. So Gethin just gets himself into the right place, and there's a sort of three abreast. He manages to get the lead outside, going through Parabolica on the inside. Peterson tucks up back into his slipstream and pulls out as I go across the line, but misses out by 0.01 of a second. But my favourite stat about that race is that there's 0.61 of a second covering the top five. Imagine being 6 tenths away from the winner and finishing fifth. Yeah. That's incredibly harsh.
Sort of like a 100-metre sprint race rather than a Grand Prix.
Exactly, yeah. So it's the nature of the victory. And it's a record-breaking one. That record stood for about 3 decades before it was broken. So what a one to win.
And he's also known as the man who won a Formula 1 race and a Formula 5000 as well, isn't he?
Yeah, the Chevron at Brands Hatch, yeah. But I think that this is a better win, probably, because he's had to...
That was an inherited win, wasn't it?
It was, really, yeah. Yeah. And he was a multiple Formula 5000 champion, a very good driver, but not really quite top draw when it came to F1, but he took his chance.
Just remind us of that average top speed without the chicanes in there.
It was just, I think it was 150.8 or
average
so.
Average speed.
Average speed, yeah.
Holy moly, that's just frightening to
hear. But what's fun about that and I'm going to say this.
There's nothing fun about that.
As a Porsche 917 fan, is that in 1771, the 5-litre sports cars were faster around Monza and Spa. Wow. So the 1,000 kilometres of Spa the following year, I think, was one at an average speed of 155 miles an hour, and that's with driver changes and pit stops and tyres, which is
frightening.
Pretty scary, isn't it?
Really frightening. Just the world coming at you fast for a really long time.
Yeah.
And the old Spa was proper scary too.
Wow. And the Monza slipstreamers as well. There was, you know, 67 is a classic Grand Prix. 69 was a great one. 71, it seemed like every other year there'd be a absolutely unbelievably brilliant Grand Prix at Monza
before
the chicanes.
Well, people get excited about Formula Ford racing, and rightly so. It's great. But basically the reason it's good is because they got no aero and they punch a hole in the air and they just slipstream around even quite small circuits. So imagine that, but with big tyres and proper engines and the best drivers in the world. Mm. I think that race holds the record, certainly it's in the top two or three, the most lead changes.
Yeah.
But that actually only counts it at the line. So there are actually far more changes. It's just that they pass each other maybe a couple of times on each. That's just one of those incredible, cool races.
Also, did you know he was team manager at Tolman for a while? Peter Gethin?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, no. And Peter Collins was brought in to replace him. Apparently, everyone really liked him, Gethin, at Tolman, but he wasn't very good. He didn't really know the job, and he lived down in Sussex and had to travel up to Whitney every day and didn't really like doing that very much. So he didn't last very long, but he was, briefly.
Has this come out of the research for your...
Yeah, it came out of the book. Yeah. My Benetton book. I mentioned my Benetton.
Well, not in this podcast, in this series, but not this episode. I think you can get away with another plug. That's fine.
Excellent. Right, let's move on. Who's next on the list?
This has got to be the most... The more time goes past, the more this race is ridiculous. So, I think, the 2012 Spanish Grand Prix, Pastor Maldonado. So, that year's Williams actually wasn't a bad car, and he qualified on... Well, he didn't qualify on pole. He actually qualified second, but Lewis Hamilton, his McLaren, didn't have enough fuel for the sample test, so he got booted to the back of the grid. So Maldonado got pole. But you think, but he's not going to stay ahead of the chasing pack for all the race. And he did actually lose the lead at one stage, but Williams got him back ahead of Fernando Alonso in a Ferrari in his mirrors. And given that Maldonado spent quite a lot of his career both in F1 and afterwards hitting objects and making mistakes, like very quick, but you would not put any money whatsoever on him holding off about the most relentless driver of the 21st century. But he did. He won the race. And that tone I've just used there, slightly high. But I every time I look at it, I just think, how did that happen? So just an astonishing performance, a great day. I think it was Frank Williams' birthday, wasn't it, as well, weekend? Yeah. And then there was a fire
at the garage.
So there was lots of conspiracy theories about, what were they using, special this or special that. But, irrespective of all that, it's just a remark. Even if it was a massive engine or something, which I don't think it was, but he still didn't fall off while being chased by Alonso. Just an incredible day.
Yeah, for me, this is very much the definition of the one-hit wonders, because there's no other race in Maldonado's career that gets anywhere near it in my mind. Like, just, like you say, obviously benefited an inherited pole, but even then, it's qualifying front row, and just, pretty much flawless race, near enough, apart from that sort of drop off the lead. But, the way he sort of controlled the pace, managed the tyres right to the end, and like you say, Alonso, at his home race, like, if there's probably anyone you wouldn't want behind you in those circumstances, it was Fernando Alonso. But, he did it, and it was just incredible. And like you say, just out of nowhere, much to the amusement of pretty much everyone that was watching.
If you're thinking of one-hit wonders as a 1980s pop one-hit wonder, like that, this probably is the definition of that, isn't it? And it also goes far as say, is it not one of the ugliest winners in F1? The car, I mean.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Not not against Pasta.
Pasta's
a lovely man.
But the car, those horrible high noses... Lots to remember about that race.
And he finished 3.2 seconds up the road from Alonso.
He did pull away in the closing stages. So I think Fernando, even then,
was like, I can't do it.
This is just not my day, chaps.
But it's funny to think that Williams had one last sort of good era after that, the Martini years.
Yeah.
And they never actually won a race, did they?
Still stands as their last victory.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, when they were quick, they were still normally quite a long way back from Mercedes, weren't they? When Red Bull and Ferrari were still getting their act together in the turbo hybrid era, they were second best, but they were still a margin behind Mercedes that would put them probably fourth or fifth now.
But they were unlucky that one didn't drop.
They would have done in previous years. But I think that they were also a little bit tentative with their strategy a couple of times when they probably had the chance to go after. Yeah. You know, they had Massa running ahead of Bottas when they should have swapped them, and just a little bit off on their strategy against a team that was just used to winning every week.
Yeah, and that sort of conservative approach at that time of, we know we're not fighting Mercedes in the championship here, but fighting the rest around there, it was like, well, let's bank the points, let's not gamble and throw it away, which that was their focus at the time. So you sort of can excuse
there's
it a little bit.
There's a lot to be said for the experience of winning and understanding what it takes to win and getting used to that habit of winning. That teams who suddenly find themselves in that situation, they haven't been there before or for a long time, it's a struggle. Mm. And I think that's a good example of that, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. That's what makes the 2012 Spanish Grand Prix even more incredible, really.
Yeah.
Okay. Who is on top of the podium?
Jean-Pierre Beltoise, 1972 Monaco Grand Prix. So as a career, he's perhaps not ahead of some of the ones later on. It's a decent career and actually had been quick in the wet before. But I spoke to Tony Southgate about this, who's the BRM designer and who's just on his way out the door at this point. But he said, you know, Beltoise was great to work with, actually, because I said to him after Pedro Rodriguez and Joe Siffert were killed, did you feel a bit, you know, obviously that was a terrible time, but did you feel a little bit like you're lacking on the drive front? I said, well, not really, because Jean-Pierre was really good. He was genuinely good. And actually the following year, he outscored teammates Niki Lauda and Clay Regazzoni. So probably a better driver than perhaps remembered, but had a sort of weak arm, which affected him perhaps in the dry a bit. But in the wet, the reason this is here is none of that. It's because it's just one of the great wet weather performances. He's fourth on the grid, which was no mean feat in the P160B, which was not a cutting-edge F1 car at that point. It wasn't even BRM's current car. The P180 hadn't been made to work yet, so they were using the older car. And he storms through from fourth, grabs the lead, and then disappears down the road. Jackie Ickx takes a little while to get back into second, and I think if you read the contemporary reports, there's an expectation that once Ickx is into second, the wet weather master will catch Beltoise. No, he finishes nearly 40 seconds behind, 38.2 seconds behind, and in third place is Emerson Fittipaldi on his way to win the world championship, and he was lapped.
Wow.
It's just one of those dominant, amazing wet weather drives that may or may not appear in a future episode of Series 3 Top 10 Podcast. So I think it's an outstanding drive that stands comparison with the great drives of multiple champions and race winners, and that's why it's on the list.
It's funny, isn't it? We're watching the World Cup at the moment. You see goals or performances from Lionel Messi, and everyone raves about him. And someone fairly unknown does exactly the same thing, and you go, oh, "That was great," but it's kind of forgotten quickly. And it's kind of that thing with Beltoise. If he was a Fittipaldi or a Stewart, this would be amongst their greatest wins and one of the great drives of all time. But because it's Jean-Pierre Beltoise, it's kind of overlooked, isn't it? So
yeah, it's a lovely good way of putting it.
Very good choice to put him number one.
So I'm sure he'll be delighted with being there, number one on this list then. They'll take that.
I mean, Southgate did say, the V12 was probably the nice, smooth delivery. It was a good engine at that point. And obviously you can throw in, Jackie Stewart was on the wrong tyres and was actually at that point suffering from a duodenal ulcer, which would actually make him miss a race. But I think that on that day, it was just a great drive, irrespective of who it was.
Yeah. I was going to ask that about what was it about the car, the engine, the familiarity with that machine, the driver on the day, familiarity with that circuit. What was it that would make him so dominant?
So the V12 was smooth, which would have helped Powder. The Cosworth DFV was known as a bit rough. Mm. So it was obviously the engine of the era. But 71, the V12 was still probably good enough to, almost as good as the FV. In 72, it was kind of fading, but it was still a very smooth engine. Which, as I say, Southgate suggested helped. I think Beltoise, if he did have any kind of physical limitation because of his arm, wasn't so obvious in the wet. And I think he was just one of those drivers in the mood on a track that reward in a track and conditions where it rewarded someone being you know, a virtuoso performance. You know, there is some footage of it, and he's quite lurid at times. You know, he's taking chances in traffic, and because initially it's like, oh, he's not in the spray, he's just pulling away. But he just carried on pulling away and diving. So he's just inspired. Mm. So I think it was a combination of right car, right driver, right place, right conditions.
And there's no luck involved, or misfortune for others, you could say. Whereas others we've mentioned quite a few times on this list, particularly the upper end, yeah, they need certain things to go their way for others to hit misfortune or whatever. None of that you could apply to this. So I can see where you put this. And also just out of nowhere as well. I didn't score anything else in that year, is that right?
No, I don't think he scored any other points.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just ridiculous.
Yeah, sort of makes it stand out even more. Like, you just look, you would see the results on the page and go, where has that come from? But
this random little fact as well, this is the one time that they ran the Monaco Grand Prix with that slightly different pit entry around the back. So along the swimming pool, where it's now the swimming pool, and they did the chicane in a different place and had the pits on that side.
Was it the last year before the swimming pool? I'm trying to think. Swimming pool was around that time, wasn't
it? Yeah, not sure. No, it was during that period. Not quite sure. It might have been a little bit later. I have to check. But yeah, I think, yeah, just following Hayden's point, I think the top two, Beltrals and Maldonado, they went out and won those races, and there was no question about it. The difference is that I think Maldonado, that's an outstanding race for Pastor Maldonado. The Beltrals win is just an outstanding race.
Full stop.
Yeah. Outstanding performance.
Yeah. I like that idea of him lapping drivers at the hairpin and them sort of doing a double take and being, the hell's that? Beltrals just flew past
and sideways. Yeah.
And then just disappearing off and being like, what? Love that thought. Hey, a brilliant podcast today. We'd always love to hear from you. By the way, you can email us podcast@autosport.com. Whenever I say this, Kev always shakes his head.
In agreement.
No. Or a well-reasoned argument. You love one of those from a fairly together...
Oh yeah, I do. To be fair, I'm sort of being slightly facetious, obviously. But to be fair, I've had thank you very much to those that have sent me sort of constructive and interesting arguments for other drivers or suggestions for top tens, actually. I'm always happy to engage.
Might get a few Sever fans not happy he's not on this list.
Yeah, he didn't make the best drivers not to win the world championship or. No. The one-hit wonders, this, did he?
The fan base won't be.
He's 11. No. 11
he was very high in my top 10 Tyrrells drivers when I did that.
I should think so.
He was.
This is why it's a fair shout.
This is why we give the email address and not our social. Because social media would just be, you're wrong. No, you're
wrong.
I feel like
Damo sunk me there right at the very end. Battleship!
I've got Kev's mobile number here. It's
just text Kev. Brilliant. We will be back this time next week for a new top 10 list in our third series. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll catch you on that one.
Sports Social Podcast Network.